Are you expecting any different audiences out there to see you this time round?
It's been 18 years ago. Did I really tour 18
years
ago?
Good Lord.
No, not really. I mean, there's a different atmosphere at my gigs now than there was 18 years ago. But I think the audiences are by and large similar. I think maybe a few more people know who I am now than did 18 years ago.
Yeah. Do you think this is, I mean, obviously there has been a very successful tour in America over the last 2 years. And has that been part of your thinking to now bring it into Europe and the rest of the world?
Yeah, my intention was to come to Europe this summer. But several important members of the band, Andy Fairweatherlow and Katie Kassoon and Doyle Bramhall, are all involved with Eric Clapton, who's been touring the entire year. So rather than change personnel, I decided that I would tour next year instead.
Now, I think, I'm sure for many of the people here and for people who come to the shows, the really good news is you're playing an awful lot of Pink Floyd, along with your own solo career, and also areas of Pink Floyd which maybe people would not expect. I mean, how did you come to choose the songs that you are working into your live set from Pink Floyd and your solo career?
Well, when I decided to do this 2 years ago, I wasn't sure whether I was going to be playing in little theatres, so we contacted some promoters in the United States, and they said, yeah, it might be possible, and they started to talk to local people, and at that point, I just started listening to the records. I went back to the very beginning and listened to the whole catalogue from start to finish, and every time I heard a song that I thought would be good to do live, I wrote it down, and I ended up with a long list. And then I whittled it, you know, I just whittled it down slowly until it became a manageable length. And then after the 99 tour, I threw a couple of songs out. In 99, I did The Powers That Be and What God Wants, which I'm not doing anymore. But the show I did last year felt good, which is what this DVD is. So I'm going to do the same thing in Europe and in the Southern Hemisphere.
Okay. Now, I know you've been back into the studio. You have been working on a new rock album. We'll talk about the opera in a moment. But is there any of that material coming into the show as well?
Only Each Small Candle, which I did last year in the States. The album, I've done two... I did nearly a month... a year ago last February in Nassau with this same band, and I did a couple of weeks in London 3 weeks ago, and I've cut 9 or 10 tracks, and I'm waiting to see how it will develop into something. It's a strange narrative about perhaps I won't go into what it's about, because I'm not really sure myself at the moment. It's work in progress, yeah.
Something that has been in progress for a long time is the opera that you've been working on, which obviously our friends here, I'm sure, will be interested in, because it's based around the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not performing any of that live, presumably?
No.
Could you tell us a little bit about the work?
Yeah, I can. It's based on a libretto that was written by Étienne Rodagil, and I've been working on it for 10 or 11 years. And I'll probably work on it for another few years. I recently finished a whole section of the work. There's about 85 minutes of the thing is now recorded with soloists. It's three soloists, a baritone, a soprano and a tenor, and a large adult chorus and a children's chorus. But I've been dissatisfied because of the way the libretto was written in the original French, it's come out as a kind of series of tableau with no strong narrative thread running through it. And recently I was in Paris working with Ishmael Lowe, who's a Senegalese singer, working on a tenor part for the section of the opera that is about the revolt in Santo Domingo in the West Indies. And I had an idea which I wrote down in the middle of the night that maybe I could find a narrative in a philosophical and emotional relationship between Marie Antoinette and a Jura priest who... So I've now got a new beginning for the whole thing, which starts off with Marie Antoinette in a walled garden, eating a peach and then sitting on a balançoire on a sink and on a swing, and a raggedy kid outside in an oak tree. And then eventually, at the end of Act Two, they all die together. She wants to become a queen, he wants to change the world, and so they both achieve their ends, but they end up dead. So in that I have discovered, I think, my narrative to hold all the tableau that are bits and pieces from the French Revolution together. But this means me going back to the piano, and I have to write a couple of new arias, and I have to write a whole new beginning, and I have to interweave this story into what I've already got. So we might be looking at a few more years of work.
Sounds like a lot of work.
It is.
Talking about a lot of work, we are about to see the release worldwide of Echoes, the Best of Pink Floyd.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you feel about that? Were you involved in that?
I don't really feel anything about it, you know. I think it's okay if the record company want to put it out and people want to buy it. It's no skin off my nose. You know, I think it's, you know.
You weren't involved in any way at all?
I was involved slightly, because James Guthrie, who put it together, kept telephoning me and bending my ear. And I didn't actually want to be involved in it, I confess. But I had a little bit of input, yeah.
Well, I think it's probably a good time now to open up the floor here to our French guests.
I think that's good.
And ask some questions to you. So, Bernard, are you going to select somebody to put some questions from the floor?
Somebody down here. Where? Right down the front. Could we have a microphone down, please? Just so we can get the sound on that.
Sorry for my bad English. If you were a teenager now, which kind of music would you play? Would you?
If I was a teenager now, well, I am a teenager at heart. I confess I'm still attracted to the same music that I was attracted to when I was a teenager, which was blues and jazz and the kind of singer-songwriter thing. I'm still really moved by songs, so I keep going back to Bob Dylan and Neil Young and John Lennon and before that to, you know, Led Belly and Bessie Smith and Billie Holiday. And I have my background, the music I always loved when I was a kid was really blues and jazz. So, you know, I don't actually listen to a great deal of modern music, but from time to time, you know, I hear a song and I think, wow, that's a good song, you know, that comes up.
About your tour, in the Flesh tour, visually it's really something. It's something of a conception. It's strong visually. It has always been with your work and your past. And we can say that most rock concerts and even other kinds of music concerts, they are very much alike. That's what I feel. In your opinion, what makes the difference? What makes that someone wants to communicate concept and all the other things are standardized and make like this? So what makes the difference for you?
I'm not sure I completely understand what you're asking me.
Why some shows are really carefully prepared visually, the message, and what makes the difference between musicians who do this and musicians who just want to play their things, have sound system, light system, and everything is standardized. I ask you this question because I know you're really careful about every little effect, every little thing. Did you understand now the question?
Yeah, I guess so. Well, I guess, you know, people are all different. So there are some people whose feelings place them in a position where they're very happy to sit at a piano in a white spotlight and sing their songs and be very calm in terms of the visual representation of their thing. And there's a certain purity in that, which I admire. You know, I don't know, somebody like that. I saw Leonard Cohen in the Olympia in Paris. I must have been at least, well, must have been nearly 30 years ago now. I remember it was just very plain white light, nothing happened to him. It was just him and a couple of girls and a bass player and a drummer. I thought it was extremely effective. There was nothing to interfere with the flow of the ideas in his songs, to me, sitting in the audience, and that's one way of doing it. I tend to do it in another way, where I search for images that will, I suppose, help me to express the feelings that I have in my songs and the ways that I want to get it over to an audience. Part of the work that I did on producing rock and roll shows when I was in Pink Floyd, though, had to do with a feeling that as the audiences grew larger and we played in larger and larger venues, I felt compelled to provide some kind of spectacle, because we were like tiny dots, you know, a long way away from most of the audience, and they couldn't see really facial body language, never mind facial experience, so it was only an oral experience unless we provided some kind of visual stimuli as well. And I've got kind of used to it, and I quite like producing images, albeit quite simple ones, that I feel enhance the experience and make it more moving. Okay. Hi. I don't know, am I going to Norway? I've no idea. I haven't looked at the list of towns that I'm going to on the European legs. So I can't answer that question. Your microphone.
You won't have much time there either.
I won't have much time.
One day.
I don't know. I'm doing 6 weeks in Europe, so I have no idea where I'm going to be or how long I'm going to be or what I'm doing, really. I'll wait to see. I'm much looking forward to it, I have to say. I'm told I haven't done anything. What, 18 years? That's 1982. 84. Pros and cons. I didn't do Radio Chaos in Europe. Oh, there you go. Yeah, okay.
Hello, as we can see just behind you, the visual of the wall is still present today, and I guess it means something really important, but because we can find it again today, and I was wondering why do you take this visual to support in the place?
This visual? Well, it's a work that I'm well known for, I suppose. Same reason anybody advertising anything uses it. You know, if you can find something iconic to for people to attach to, then I think it's legitimate to use it. So that's the reason. The reason for all of this is so that people, you know that I'm going to be doing this tour and hopefully go out and buy tickets and come on the shows that's successful. That obviously is the point of this press conference. And it may be that the imagery of the wall helps people to understand that I'm connected with that. Because believe it or not, when I started doing solo work in 85 and did that tour, it came as an enormous surprise and shock to me that very few people had any idea that I had anything to do with Pink Floyd. And so I use that to make that connection to some extent. Now, it's changed now. You know, now it's different. I was touring the States last year. You know, the show, we had a good time. We sold lots of tickets. The people in the audience clearly knew exactly who I was and what I'd done. And so I'm hoping that Europe will be like that. We shall see. Okay.
Hi, Roger.
Hi.
I was wondering, what do you think about the music and the internet? Did it bother you, for instance, that a few years ago, some of your shows were available on the internet only a few days after the performance.
Some of my shows?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You mean from 99?
I didn't make it, but I don't really do a lot of shows from that time.
Well, you know, what can I say? One has to take one's hat off to the video pirates and, you know, and say, well done, you know. I don't know, that whole arena of intellectual property rights is a strange and difficult one in the light of the technological revolutions that we're facing in the internet, but I can't, that's not something that concerns me really. I'll let other people worry about that. You know, it's really a question for the hackers and the lawyers. It doesn't really concern me at all, you know. If people want to steal the shows, good luck to them, you know, I don't care, frankly.
Hello? May I have two questions, please?
Sure.
First one is about visual effects in your show. As you said before, visual effects are a great part of your shows, but they are not matchable with small venues. So do you intend or not to play one day in small venues, a pure musical show in small venues like Olympia?
Do you know, I actually discovered, I did a show on the last tour of a place called The Gorge, which is near Seattle in Washington State. And it was so windy that we couldn't use any of the projections. We couldn't use any of the visual stuff. And lo and behold, surprise, surprise, it didn't seem to make any difference to the show at all. I think the connection is actually in the music and the lyrics, and that the visual things are peripheral by and large. And I have no question but that if I decided to go into small theatres, you know, whether it was Olympia or... I remember years and years ago with the Floyd doing gigs in the Théâtre Champs-Élysées, which was a very intimate space and a wonderful place to perform. And I have no doubt that should I go and do gigs like that with a single light bulb and a good band and sing my songs, that would be very satisfying to me and to the audience as well, in the same way that these are. But, at the moment, I've sorted out this show that I'm doing and it's very satisfying, and there's a great empathy between me and the audience, which I adore. I've arrived at a place in my own personal journey now where I'm much more open to the idea that it's okay for me to be have a loving relationship with an audience, and that what I feel when I'm in front of an audience, which is enormous pleasure, is okay. I allow myself that pleasure now, and so I'm just having a good time when I'm on the road. Yeah. But, you know, I would like that other thing too, you know. When I go and see a Randy Newman show, which I do as often as I possibly can, and he sits down, plays the piano and sings his songs, it's magical. It's a magical experience.
Let's make the wish to have this magical experience.
Okay.
In the future. So my second question is about your concert in Berlin in next June, on the 9th, I guess. Will it be 11 years after the war live in Berlin, a special show in Berlin for you? During this In the Flesh tour?
I think your math is correct. It will be 11 years, yeah. I'm sorry, but that's not the question. I'm not trying to be funny. What's your question? I don't understand.
Will it be a special show for you and for the audience in Berlin during this Flesh tour?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe it will. I don't know. I'm not sure how much connection I will make or they will make. I don't know what the venue is that we're playing in. I'm sure there will be some kind of edge to it because of what happened in 89 and 90. I shall certainly go and have a look at the Potsdamer Platz, and, you know, I haven't been back since 1990, so it's all covered in McDonald's and Sony buildings, I assume, you know, like almost everywhere else in the world.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
I have a question here. What moved you to tour for Amuse Bouche and In the Flesh after 8 years? Amuse Bouche is 92, and you start touring in 99. So what changed your mind about that? My second question is about you're touring bigger venue in Europe than USA, quite the double. So is there any enhancement in that way too?
Well, to take the second question first, I didn't know I was doing bigger venues in Europe then. the minimum.
Venues in Europe are nearly held close to 20,000 when you told 8,000 in USA.
Well, no, actually, quite a lot of them in USA were 20,000 as well. A lot of the sheds in the USA, if you sell them out, there's about 7,000 undercover and 15,000 on the lawn, and we sold quite a few of those out. So it sounds as if they're similar. So for a minute, I was worried that you were going to tell me I was playing to 50,000 people, you know, which would be a...
With that no stadium.
No stadiums, exactly. So, but... So long as I'm not playing in stadiums, I think you can make a connection with 20,000. In fact, I know you can. You know, I've done it, and it feels okay to me. It feels satisfactory. To answer your other question, I had a tough time on the road, particularly in the States, when I did Radio Chaos, which was in 1987. It was hard. I was playing in 8-10,000 seater arenas to 2,000 people or 1,500 people, and I think it was very good for my character, but it was also tough, you know, particularly as my ex-colleagues were playing in football stadiums, sometimes in the same week in the same town, for 70 or 80,000 people, and so I didn't want to go through that experience again. And when Amused to Death came out, I told Sonny that I would tour Amused to Death, which I wanted to do, but only if there was a market for it, and I decided, maybe rightly or wrongly, to gauge that market based on record sales. So I said, if you move 2 million units, I will go on the road. And they didn't. You know, we sold about 800,000-900,000. So I said, okay, well then I'm not doing it. But in '92, I was in Los Angeles working on Amused to Death, and Don Henley, who sang some harmony parts, and who I'd known from before and is a friend anyway, asked me to do a gig at the Universal Amphitheatre in support of his Walden Woods project. And I did. And the evening was Don, Neil Young, John Fogerty, and me. And we kind of shared the evening. And I did 4 or 5 songs using his band. And when I walked, and no show or anything, so it's what you were talking about earlier. It was just me and a band on stage in a relatively small auditorium. And when I walked on stage and started playing, I can't remember what I played, Mother, I think I started playing Mother. So there was this incredible sort of affection and pleasure that came from the 5,000 or 6,000 people that were there. And I was bowled over by it, and I was very moved by the whole experience. And I saw it being played out with the other guys who were performing later on in the evening as well. And I determined at that point that this was something that I really wanted to do again. I discovered that the performer in me was prepared to reestablish that relationship. And it took me another 7 years to, you know, find the right time or to summon the courage to put my toe back into the water of that arena. And I liked it, so I'll probably just go on doing it for a bit. And I'm playing the Southern Hemisphere starting in February and through March, and then I'm doing 6 weeks in Europe. I'm not going back to the States because I've done it now, a couple of years on the run, and that'll be that. I won't do this material again, but I may well go on the road with new material. I mean, the songs that I've been working on this new album, I know that every day when we arrive at a sound check, I will not be able to resist the temptation to pick up my acoustic guitar and start playing one of the new songs. And I know that the band will pick up, and I know we will be playing those songs on this tour, just not in front of the audiences, because the temptation is too great, you know, not to perform them. I don't know if that had anything to do with what you asked me, but... It felt, maybe it did.
As the lady said, the worries are very important for you, and there is a movie also, and I would like to know, how do you see the movie now after almost 20 years? What is your look on the movie now?
Well, I funnily enough, I watched the movie in Paris a few years ago, because there was a DVD made. And Gerald Scarfe and I sat in a room at the Creon and did a commentary on it. So if you want to know what I think about it, if you get the DVD and listen to the commentary.
Yes, I have it.
Okay. I thought that the movie was a bit dour, you know. There's not much humor, not many laughs in it.
Yes,
and that is that is a considerable regret to me, I have to say, at this point. And in fact, from time to time, I dip into my Scion, where I have got a new version of The Wall that I write on aeroplanes, which is a version for Broadway, a theatrical version. And the only reason that I work on it is sort of a little hobby of something I do if I'm on an aeroplane and can't, you know, and I've finished my book. I mean, the reason that I'm doing this is twofold. One is because I like the idea of a version which has got jokes in it. So I'm writing it as a sort of a comedy version of The Wall.
Really?
Yes, really. What's the second reason? The second reason is that in the 20 years that have gone by since I wrote the piece, I've been on a strange and convoluted personal journey of self-discovery. And it may be that through that process, I may have started to discover what may be the end of the piece. And I'd like to put that in the play when I find out what it is. I'd like it to be the end of the play.
You found it now.
I'm not sure. I'm definitely a lot closer to it than I was in 1980. Mm-hmm. There's no question about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not quite as, I'm nowhere near as consumed with fear, you know, as I was then.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay.
What do you think about bands saying Pink Floyd music and your music is their first influence, like Radiohead or Dream Theater and others?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that. What do I think about the influence?
Bands saying your first influence, like Radiohead. What do you think about Radiohead or...
Radiohead. Well, I have been told over the years that they're a wonderful band and very talented. And in fact, my son, who's 23 years old, my oldest son, gave me OK Computer for my birthday a couple of months ago. And I listened to it and I really liked it. I thought there were some beautiful songs on it. And then somebody else, an American record producer, gave me the new album. So I've been showered with Radiohead projects suddenly. And the new album, my son, quite difficult, I have to say, and I wouldn't dream of listening to it again. I played it once in the car, and I thought, wow, this is weird, you know. So this is what the young people are buying these days. Because in my work, I'm drifting back towards Woody Guthrie. You know, I'm finding that I'm using less and less effects and going more and more back towards a simple kind of rendition and expression of my ideas in a simple way. But I admire and appreciate what Radiohead are trying to do. It doesn't personally appeal to me particularly. I've been told that they claim some influence from some of the things that I may have done in the past, but, which is good. I mean, but I don't really feel anything about it.
Thank you. Hi, Roger.
Hi.
I have two questions. I wanted to know, if you must know a band called Placebo. Placebo?
No.
You don't know, it's an English band, and they're very famous worldwide, Placebo.
I'm sorry, I know very little about popular music. It's not one of my areas of expertise. I'm quite good on Arsenal Football Club. Or
My point actually was more talking, they have a single called Tasting Men, and they use the intro of Let There Be More Light without mentioning it. I wanted to know if you knew it.
No,
that's all.
I don't know.
They
that.
Don't mention it, and they just copied the intro.
Was that testing or tasting?
Taste in men.
Oh, taste in
men.
Ah.
They just copying the intro. I wanted to know if you knew it.
No, I don't know that.
You must listen to it.
Okay.
And my second question, when you wrote 26 years ago songs like Wish You Were Here or Shine On You, Crazy Diamond, it was very obvious that you were concerned in what Syd Barrett was becoming. And are you still keeping in touch and concerned about what's becoming of him now today?
Interestingly enough, there's a guy in England called, I think his name's Ted Willis, who is writing a book about Sid, and I've been talking to him on the telephone. I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago, and he then called me back because he visited Sid and described his encounter with Sid, which was kind of quite interesting. But so Sid is living, you know, in a terrace house in Cambridge, still living in apparently reasonable comfort on the royalties from the old stuff. He's still schizophrenic. He on this particular day, the guy went up and knocked on the door and Sid came out and was standing there in a pair of pale blue wife fronts, you know, looking bemused as he always does when people go and visit him. And then Ted was so sort of taken aback by being confronted in that way, that he forgot to tell Sid that he was writing a book and he needed to talk to him. So he went back and Sid was gardening, and Ted said to him, "I've got some questions here," because he'd written down or something for him, and "can I give it to you?" And Sid said to him, "I don't care what you do." He said, "You put it through the door." And Ted said, "Should I put it through the door?" And Sid said, "It's nothing to do with me. You can do what you want with it. It's nothing to do with me." So I thought that was interesting, in that Sid clearly sees that whole past thing and people being interested in it. It's nothing to do with who he is or what he is now. So he has a schizophrenic relationship with that too. And in a way, I think that probably makes things easier for him, that he doesn't feel a need to relate who he is now to who he was then. So I took some comfort from that conversation that I had with Ted Willis, because over the years I have made inquiries from time to time as to whether it would or would not be a good thing for me to make contact or whatever, and everything that's come back to me from Ruth, who's his sister, and from his family, is no. He gets very agitated when he's reminded of the past, and he's much best left alone. So that's all I can tell you.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you, Roger. You answered my question. You want to answer my question?
Okay.
I just wanted to say you the same thing.
Okay.
One last one, then.
Hello. Back to the old DVD and this DVD. I would like to know what you think about surround sound. There is surround mixes on the wall and this DVD. Maybe. Is the surrounding music is an additional factor of creation for you, for now and the future?
Quadraphonic sound, you mean?
Yeah, quadraphonic and surround.
Well, I mean, I use it in my live shows. So,
yeah, I know, but for the records, for the future records, creation for you.
Oh, I see. I don't think about that.
No, not at all.
Well, you know, I mean, with TV and DVDs and everything, now everything's being mixed in 5.1. It's just something that's slowly coming in the Western world, you know, where we can afford to buy 5 speakers and put them around our living rooms and, you know, sit down and surround ourselves. It's, I don't know, it's a bit like talking about traction drive on a Audi 400 or something. It's like, you know, it's just something that happens. I never think about that. It's not something that concerns me.
So you were not involved in the work for the DVD, for example, in the flesh. You were not involved in the surround mixes.
Only insofar as when we were putting the show together, I worked with Nick Griffiths, who's, you know, an engineer that I've worked with a lot, and who does all the technical work putting together the show. Yeah, when I'm putting the show together, I sit in a room with him and we listen to it and say, see how it'll work and decide what movements to make and how everything works. So putting the show together, obviously, you know, that's part of the thing. It's like putting the visuals, it's like rehearsing the band, it's like getting ready for the show. Yeah. I'm sorry if I misunderstood your question.
No, it's okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks, everyone. That was really good. Thank you very, very much indeed.
Okay, thank you.